For those who I haven't met, my name is Ethan Tucker. I want to welcome you to Hajar. Special welcome to those for whom it's your first time ever learning here. This is a place of learning all year round, and this is one of the many programs that we do. There's some postcards about our other fall programming that you should have either on your chair or a chair near you. So we hope if it is your first time, it'll be the first of many times. And I also want to acknowledge here the presence of our full-time fellows, the full-time fellows who anchor this Beit Midrash day in, day out, and make it a place of learning for the broader community to be a part of. So we're really, really thrilled to be here together. This evening is the beginning of our five-part fall lecture series, which is going to run Thursday nights until Thanksgiving. It is going to have an arc, but we also know that sometimes folks will not be able to make an individual session, and we'll try to make that accessible. And our topic, as you know, is strangers, aliens, and fellow travelers, the rabbinic concept of ger toshav and its relevance for contemporary Jewish politics. I want to say a few words of introduction about that before we get into the sources that we'll learn together. The ger toshav was a kind of resident alien that we'll define with greater precision as we go forward, has made a surprising comeback after centuries of living merely in the minds of rabbinic scholars. This is a category of person who was really truly only present in societies where Jews were the majority and or where Jews had power and influence over others. And it was, therefore, for much of Jewish history, largely a theoretical construct. And nonetheless, just in the past year, we have seen a number of key areas where this figure has been resurrected as a possible model for thinking about minorities and difference in societies governed or influenced by Jewish values. I want to primarily highlight two. 2017 marked 50 years since Israel's conquest of Yehuda and Shomron and its failure or unwillingness to annex those territories and grant citizenship to all those living there. We are now half a century into an experiment with no obvious end of Israeli, and by that I mean Jewish, control of millions of Gentiles who have an ambiguous and hybrid political status. It's also unsurprisingly been a year, that 50-year anniversary, that has triggered further thinking and strategizing as to how the state of Israel should proceed with regard to this predicament. Bezalel Smotrich, some of you may know, who's a leading member of the Jewish Home Party in Israel's Knesset, Abayit HaYehudi, has been among the most controversial and vocal figures in this discussion, and he has advocated for full annexation of all of the West Bank, to be followed by implementation of what he calls his Tochnit Hachra'ah, his plan for resolving the territorial dispute with the Palestinians once and for all. And the plan, based on Midrashic traditions regarding Joshua's statecraft when conquering the land, aims to offer Palestinians three choices. One, to leave the country. Two, to fight and take their chances against the IDF in a total war, or three, to agree to the status of ger toshav. Okay, that's how the plan is framed. Now, this plan and the rhetoric around it has rightly unsettled and outraged many, but my purpose in this series is not to engage with a plan, that plan, or really any other plan per se. It's to dig deeper into what would that third option really entail. What precisely would it look like to have a permanent population of Gentile gerim v'toshavim in the state of Israel, were we to be guided by biblical and rabbinic sources on this matter? For anyone who supports Smotrich's plan, answering that question and being accountable to the answer is a moral, religious, and theological imperative. But for those who deeply oppose it, I think shedding light on the high burden our tradition places on caring for the ger toshav is also centrally important. And one thing I learned and experienced in Israel over the past 2 years is how the vision of not dividing the land, whether out of a one-state vision or a long-term pessimism, is gaining ground on both right and left. And that means that even the most passionate two-staters may need to be prepared to confront a reality where non-citizens are the wards of the state for a period of longer, maybe much longer than 50 years, and that demands raising a serious conversation about basic obligations towards non-citizens, even in transitional times. And I think the model of the Ger Toshav has something to teach us here, both as a source of direction and caution. 2017 also saw the ascendance of an American president and administration that have taken an approach to immigration and non-citizen residents of the United States that is a radical departure from recent administrations of both political parties. Both in rhetoric and executive order, the president has targeted those who do not have a fully protected status under the Constitution, or at least those where such protection is grayer than it is for its citizens. And while the various proposed and implemented travel bans have garnered a lot of attention and activism, the most intense resistance has surrounded non-citizens who already live in the country. And indeed, even the president's own xenophobic and isolationist rhetoric has been much more erratic when dealing with the so-called dreamers who evoke broad sympathy, even among those generally hostile to amnesty and naturalization. And the confusion here stems somewhat from a lack of vision as to how to think about those who are not citizens, cannot vote, have not gone through legal channels to be naturalized, but who are unmistakably a part of the larger society living on this land. Voices in the Jewish community have been particularly animated about these issues, and here too, the biblical Ger, who we will focus on tonight, has reared its head as a model. The homiletical value of the Ger, the stranger, is often emotionally overwhelming and persuasive, which I think the Torah itself kind of intends. But my question for us is, can we also dig deeper into the category of Ger Toshav for more practical perspectives on society's responsibilities to all residents? And here, too, I think we can enrich our discussion as American Jews fighting for others by a deeper engagement with our textual and normative tradition, even when it is thin and maybe even speculative. In particular, I want us to train our eyes throughout this series, when we look at the texts that we're going to study together, for five kinds of categories: rights, responsibilities, privileges, freedoms, and burdens. I'll say them again. Rights, responsibilities, privileges, freedoms, and burdens. And as we proceed through this series, I'm going to ask you to help us return to those categories, to help us sketch out potential visions for what citizenship and or residency entail. All right, a final word before we begin of what I am not doing in this series. First and most important, I am not presenting you with a polished, finished product in an effort to persuade you of a grand vision for how we ought to address the Israeli-Palestinian conflict or U.S. immigration policy. For that matter, I'm not even presenting you with a tidy reading of all the sources we're going to study together. We are in the lab together on this journey over the next few weeks, and I am learning right alongside with you. And I want you to bring your questions, your critiques, your corrections, even as we learn text, and hope we will emerge wiser together. Second, and also important, I am not claiming that the actual category of the biblical ger, the stranger, or the rabbinic ger toshav, the resident alien in rabbinic law, are perfect or even appropriate mapping of the categories of non-citizens that I talked about earlier. Arab residents of territories controlled by Israel are quite plainly not residents in a foreign land, even if a state constructed as Jewish will always tend to bestow some notion of otherness on them. Refugees trying to enter a country as adults are not the same as those born in it, or even those brought to it as little children, even if all of those were to lack citizenship. And the possibility of naturalizing, and how realistic that possibility is, of course, has an enormous impact on our assessment of what options does a society offer in terms of basic protection at least, and robust flourishing at most to those who live in it. So I want to avoid the temptation to find perfectly reincarnated gerim v'toshavim in our midst. Rather, I want to look at the values that are surfaced by the discussion of the ger toshav. That should be our focus, and that I think has a lot to teach us. Okay, so with that, I want to start with the Bible. Tonight is going to be devoted to the Tanakh and the character of the ger. So we're going to begin on the source sheet that you've got in front of you. And this is going to be a kind of, comprehensible, but also somewhat intentionally head-spinning survey of what does the Bible, what does the Torah and beyond have to say about this character of the ger. Now, let's just say something first about who the ger is, all right? We're not yet at the rabbinic development of this. Let me say one other preliminary thing here. If I were to ask many of you in this room just to define the word ger, many of you, with some knowledge of the way it's used in Hebrew and in rabbinic text, would say it means convert. Okay? That is not what it means in the Torah, though we're going to feel that and see that very clearly in a second. The ger is a character who is not an Israelite, who lives in Israelite society. The ger appears parallel to, sometimes overlapping with, the character of the Nochri, the foreigner. And the difference between the ger and the Nochri is actually very profound. When I teach this material in Israel, I explain the ger is the Thai worker who lives in South Tel Aviv. The Nochri is the guy staying in the Hilton for the weekend. Okay? The Nochri is a foreigner who comes in and spends some time, comes in, goes out, and even to the extent he sticks around for a while, he is not striking roots. The Torah in a lot of places, the Tanakh in a number of places, pairs the term Nochri with Eretz Rechoka. Okay? A Nochri asher yavo me'eretz Rechoka, a faraway, distant land. The ger, by contrast, lives but is somehow other in the place where the majority is found. All right, the ger that we are going to be looking at is that character, and we're going to try to take off the rabbinic glasses that we often use to read the Torah. Don't worry, we'll get to that next week. It's not a Karaite seminar here. We will get to looking at the rabbinic interpretation, but to understand what the rabbinic interpretation of the ger is about, you have to first read the Torah on its own. And that's what we're going to spend time doing tonight. Let's look at this term. Where does the Torah, where does the Tanakh talk about the ger? And what picture or pictures emerge of how this individual is to be treated? Did you have your hand? Yeah.
I missed something. Does it matter if the Thai worker is first or second generation?
Good. We'll get to that. So far, let's assume it does not matter. Okay? As another point, perhaps, of introduction here, reading the Bible on its own terms, not just does ger not mean convert for reasons that will be obvious, it's not clear there is such a notion of a non-Israelite male being able to become an Israelite male. That is to say, you are from another nation with a different gene line, chromosome line, bloodline, whatever you want to describe it, and you remain a descendant of that group. Women might be another story in terms of their ability to marry into a patriarchal society that can absorb them, like the story of Ruth. But for the purposes so far, we'll see it's going to get complicated later, we can assume a ger is someone who is part of another nation. A character who appears, for instance, at the beginning of the book of Shmuel Bet, is this character who comes from the battlefield claiming actually to have struck the final death blow to put King Saul out of his misery. He's described as a ger amaleki, as a resident alien who is of Amalek. He's not the first generation of Amalekite in the land, right? So there's a sense that this is a hereditary category that gets assigned to people who are not Israelites, but they live there. Okay? All right. Let's begin. One more comment, and then we're going to jump in.
Are you going to bring into the discussion the category of natim?
Not for the most part, though when we get to some of the rabbinic sources, maybe. But for now, we're not going to treat that as a separate group. has its own origins, Book of Joshua, the Gibbonim, etc. So my main answer to you is no, but I'm happy to discuss it afterwards. Okay, good. Let us just look at a few things here in section A, the Ger's place in society. I just want you to get a feel here very quickly for some of the ways the Torah uses this term before we get to the question of how should we normatively treat the Ger, which is going to be our topic. The question is, descriptively, who are we talking about here? Okay? So in Brit Ben HaBitarim, the covenant between the pieces, God's real covenantal moment with Abraham, what is said there? Ki ger yezaracha be'eretz lo lahem. Your descendants are going to be a ger in a foreign land. Meaning, when projecting forward to the story of what are the people of Israel classified as when they're in Egypt, they're gerim. Right? That already gives you a picture, first of all, of what it is to be a foreigner, but also some notion of they're the first people you're going to enslave. Okay? It almost follows. It says, Geri Yazaracha, Vavadum, Ve'inuotam. They're going to be a foreigner. You can almost read it as, and therefore, they're going to end up enslaving them and oppressing them. It's a very logical progression. Okay? You see this in other narrative places, like the story of Sodom and Lot. When Lot shows up in the city of Sodom, and they feel, the people of the town feel, that he is passing judgment on them, the way they express that is, Hayachad balagur vayishpot shafot, someone shows up. Now, lagur, if you know a little too much modern Hebrew, you'll say it means, well, he lives there. But lagur is the verbal form of to be a stranger, right? Think back to the Haggadah. Lo yarad Yaakov avinu lishtakea b'mitzrayim ela lagur sham. Jacob didn't go down to Egypt to strike roots, but to kind of hang out there for a while. Okay? So, Echad Balagur, you, the people of Sodom, say to Lot, you're a Johnny come lately, you just came here, you are not part of us, and you're going to judge us. The Ger is also someone who's not supposed to display kind of signs of power and judgment and superiority. All right? All sorts of other places. Perhaps Abraham, when he's trying to bury Sarah in front of the Hittites, is a very striking other example where he begs the Hittite council for a place to bury Sarah, and says, Ger v'toshav anochi imachem, I'm a stranger and a toshav, another term we'll come across, I dwell amongst you. And what do we learn from that story? What is Avraham really saying? He's saying, I'm a ger, therefore I have no land here. Therefore I have to beg you for a burial plot, because you control all the territory. And that is another thing we will see is very distinctive about the ger. The ger, in terms of Israelite society, has no achuzah, has no place, literally a handhold in the land or foothold in the land of any kind of tribal location where things can be inherited. Right? You get a sense here of the vulnerability, the sense of someone who's in the society but doesn't have the same sort of claim to all sorts of privileges and protections. I think the most incredible example of this, and what I've labeled labor force here, is a story told in Divrei Hayamim. The parallel narrative in the Book of Kings does not say this, but in the Chronicles version of Shlomo's building projects, including the temple and all of the rebuilding of Jerusalem, it says that Shlomo did a census of all the Gerim in the land of Israel, found that there were 153,600 of them, and then put them to work. Okay, it doesn't seem like they're getting a monthly salary. They're probably getting fed and supported. But basically, this is a group you can commandeer to work for you. There's very eerie parallels, obviously, to the Paro, B'nai Yisrael in Egypt story here. But straight up, that's part of what may happen to a ger. They may be pressed into labor. And on some level, the most poignant explanation of the place that the ger occupies in society is the rhetorical use to which the ger is put in Dvarim, in what we know as the Tochacha, the sort of long list of unbearable curses if the people don't follow God. And here we find it says, you know how bad it's going to get? Hager ashir bekirbecha ya'ale alecha mala mala ve'ata tered mata mata. The ger is going to go higher and higher, and you're going to go lower and lower. What do we learn from that? The normal order of things, well, there are two things on that, first of all. I hope it's clear from the last one. Ger does not mean convert, right? It should be clear from all of them, but from that one it should be really clear. There's you, and then there's the ger. This is not someone who joins the group. And the normal order of things is this is the person. They are the charity case, right? Hu yalvecha ve'ata lo talvenu. But in the upside down world, he's going to lend you money, as opposed to you lending him, which is the normal way, whether it's supposed to be, we can leave aside, but it's the normal way it is. Hu yihyeh l'rosh ve'ata tihyeh l'zanav. He'll be the head, you'll be the tail. What's the normal state of affairs? The ger is the tail. Okay? So here, it gives you a little bit of a taste of who are we talking about. All right? And again, as I said, we can probably map onto a lot of things we see in contemporary society and find things that don't match perfectly. We are talking about someone who is not a member of the main group, does not have all the kind of social protections, network, power, etc., etc., and is vulnerable. I haven't yet gotten to anything about how you're supposed to behave, but this is the picture.
Yeah. Ethan, of course, the most interesting source here is about real estate. And it seems, in contrast, Abraham's objective here is to own real estate. And so, is it perhaps possible to read this text as to say, because I am a ger in Boshav, I have license to become a landowner?
Say, explain it. Why would he have license to become a landowner?
Abraham is trying to acquire real estate.
Yeah.
Right? If he said, I live in Tunisia, but I'd like to buy a piece of property here.
Aha.
His justification of being able to buy property and own property is that I'm a guarantee.
Is I actually live here. Okay, good. So what I would say to you is, to the extent Abraham is fighting off the feeling that he's a nohri, right? He's just the guy who's coming in for a visit, then Ger may have that veil, right? But it's also unmistakable, even if he's using it that way, that the fact that he has to beg them for land shows that at least from the starting point is that he does not have access to that land unless the local council gives it to him. You're right that you could imagine a certain ethos existing whereby the local council would have a sort of certain benevolent, you know, munificence towards the ger, which we'll see in a minute. The Torah, at some level, is going to command. That's an interesting question of how much we should read that back into B'nai Chet.
There's a flip side of that, if it's good enough for Adam, it's good enough for the Thai worker. You know, that if Adam was able to buy land there, then they should be able to buy land here.
Right, Abraham, yeah. So that'll be the question of where that model goes. For now, we're going to get also by the end of tonight to the question of land. Right here, let's just say it's pretty clear that Abraham in that story is vulnerable. Whether ger is also a talking point in addition to a starting point of vulnerability, that's interesting. Let's keep our eye on that. Okay? All right, good. Let's move forward now. And I want to give you a sort of number of different categories that I want to look at this character through, and I'll ask you periodically to jump in and read. The Torah has a surprising, okay, before we get into the details, I want us to note, the Torah has a perhaps surprising general attitude towards the ger. My colleague Rabbi Shai Held has talked about this in other contexts at great length, which is to love the ger. Right? In other words, if I had to say to you, you know, we were playing like, you know, Torah 20 questions, and it was ger, good or bad, okay? The Torah's answer is good. Right? That's what should not be taken for granted. And you see that, I think, in its most powerful form here in Vayikra Yud-Tet, in a verse I want you to sort of hear everything it's combating here. V'chi agur itcha ger ba'artzechem lo tonu oto. When a stranger resides with you in your land, you shall not wrong him, or better, perhaps, take advantage of him. Ke'ezrach mikem yihye lachem ager agar itchem. The ger should be like the ezrach. Those knowing modern Hebrew jump immediately to translate it as citizen. I'm not sure citizen is the possible translation in a text like the Torah. Ezrach is used elsewhere in the Bible. There's the phrase Ezrach ra'anan, which seems to be some kind of plant. So perhaps native in the sense of planted or growing out of the soil as opposed to being grafted on. The Ezrach is the opposite of the ger. The Ezrach is sort of the fully credentialed and enfranchised Israelite. The ger should be like the ezrach. You shall love the ger like yourself. Ve'ahavta lo kamocha, ki gerim hayitem be'eretz Mitzrayim. Because you were gerim, after all, in the land of Egypt. Now, there's actually something about this phrase and this verse which I think is playing off of every assumption to the contrary in each of the clauses here. What would you normally think about the ger? Not to treat them like the citizen. So the Torah comes and tells you, no, treat them like the citizen. What would you normally, your normal instinct to the ger be? Not to love them as much as yourself. Right? You might say, you might even be a very good person. Right? The same way I might say, right, in a certain way, I don't love someone else's kids as much as my kids. Okay? Or in terms of my loyalties or my priorities, I think we would, most of us feel that was appropriate. You shouldn't think your kids are like ontologically superior to someone else's kids. But when you talk about loving them, you might love them more. That's a natural way you might feel of, I care more about the citizen than the non-citizen or the native as opposed to the ger. And the Torah is saying, again, quite surprisingly, no, right? Love that person as much as you love yourself. And I skipped the first one, right? Don't take advantage of them. We're starting on the basic thing of what's the first thing that many people would, in fact, have the instinct to do? To take advantage of that person, right? You would say, this person isn't really under my protection. It's for them to look out for themselves. I'm not saying whether that would be a moral stance, but the Torah here is aware that the way someone would normally relate to the ger without any kind of moral check placed on them is, take advantage of them. After all, they're not as important to me. After all, they're not native-born citizen, etc. And the Torah is hitting hard here with an overall view. You have to treat this person in exactly the opposite of those ways. The other sources on the page just sort of play out some of the broad way in which that's supposed to play out, which is basically, there's food you drop on the ground when you're harvesting. That's got to go to the orphan, the widow, and the ger, and the stranger, and all sorts of other places where you can and should include the ger and allow them to be a recipient of kindness and charity. That's what the Torah intends you to do. That's the sort of easy piece of the picture here. Yeah.
This is really amazing. At least for me. I just finished a great book by Professor Sapolsky of Stanford, my favorite guy, called Behave, and he shows how the, from a neuroscience point of view, us versus them is built into us, even at 3 months old, maybe 3 days old. So the Torah is asking us to go against our essentialism.
So I want to, good, so I want to affirm that and complicate it, okay? I want to affirm 100% what you're saying is correct, vis-a-vis the divide, though we'll get to the, some of the nitty-gritty in a minute, the divide between the Israelite by essence and the next door neighbor who is the ger, who is not Israelite by essence. And there is some degree of blurring or equating between those two. However, that is not true of the Nochri. That is not true at all, I think you can say, of the foreigner. There is not some robust notion of breaking down us versus them vis-a-vis the insider and the outsider. The actual revolution here is the claim that the ger is the insider. Right? Here to go back, and again, this is not about endorsing policy proposals, but I'm just sort of to sharpen this. It would be to say something like, yeah, you can have all the travel bans you want, but you can't throw the dreamers out. In other words, that's someone else. They want to come in. That's not your problem. That's the Nochri. You want to let him in? Okay, let him in. You don't owe them any. But this person who lives in the place that you control, okay? Now, you obviously might carry those categories of the ger and the nochri and draw the line in different places. I just use that as a kind of graphic distinction between what it means to broaden the circle of us without negating the them. And that's, I think, actually the real punch of what's happening with the ger. We're going to see that in much more powerful ways in a minute when we get to the normative behavior of the ger as the Torah envisions. Okay, one more comment on this. Yeah.
Can you talk about how this stacks up against the surrounding cultures? Is this a critique against Mesopotamia, Assyria?
Yeah, so here too, this, I'm afraid, actually, a number of lectures on our website by my colleague, Rabbi Held, who one of the things that he really emphasizes and writes in his recent commentary on the Torah is, yes, widows and orphans are all over the Middle East. That is totally common. There is really nothing parallel to this. There's nothing parallel to the bottom source on page 2 to getting up at Har Gerizim and Har Eval when the people gather to have a sort of national sealing of the covenant. And one of the things you preemptively curse people for is if they will take advantage or somehow pervert the mishpat ger, the law or the legal treatment of the ger. That we don't have really any parallel. Right? So there's something very striking about this. We don't yet know why. Right? In other words, what is this about? Part of my response to you was to say, I don't think it's about completely eviscerating group identity, but to the extent the ger is in, what is it about the ger that makes us tend towards equality or towards responsibility, even though they are other in some sense? Okay, turn forward to page 3. Page 3, before we get into some of the more lovey-dovey stuff, let's be clear of some of the harder edge here of what it means still to be other. Okay? What I've called here permitted discrimination. Okay? One of the things that does seem to be different between Israelites / Jews and all Gentiles is the question of whether one can lend money on interest to them. It seems pretty clear from the way the Torah relates economically to the prohibition of interest that it is reserved as a prohibition to achicha, to your brother, to your kinsman. Right? And here's another key thing. The ger is part of you, but the ger cannot really be described as achicha. When the Torah uses a term saying your kinsman, your brother, a more narrow circle is intended. And that seems to suggest that you don't have the ger plucked out from the nochri in this situation. You've got la nochri tashich ula achicha lo tashich. You take interest from the foreigner, you don't take interest from your brother. Okay? You could imagine, we may see this next week, a stretched, expansive reading of this that would say, no, the ger is not a nochri, so he must in some sense be your brother, metaphorically, and he's included in that. But I would say a plain sense of the reading of the Torah, and Jacob Milgram and other Bible scholars stand their ground on this very strongly, is that no. The prohibition on lending on interest, which is essentially a kind of compulsory charity, that is reserved for other Israelites, for other Jews. And we get a little bit of a sense there of the ger being protected, kind of equal, but maybe not the same. Even if you want to evade that text, the next text is a very important, striking example here. So Vayikra 25. All right, someone want to read this for us in either language, and those can folks can follow in the opposite language on the page. Vayikra 25. Please.
If your kinsman under you continues in straits and must give himself over to you, do not subject him to the treatment of a slave. He shall remain with you as a hired or bound laborer. He shall serve with you only until he comes. Then he shall be free of your authority. He shall go back to his family and return to his ancestral holding. For they are my servants, whom I freed from the land of Egypt. They may not give themselves over to slavery. You shall not rule over him ruthlessly. You shall fear your God.
Bottom line, you buy an Israelite as a slave, he's a slave. You can't buy an Israelite slave. You get a maximum to the Jubilee year, it's indentured servitude, there is a term limit, and then he goes free. But
such male and female slaves as you may have, it is from the nations round about you that you may acquire male and female slaves. You may also buy them from among your children, aliens resident among you, or from their families that are among you, whom they begot in your land.
First generation, second generation. Yeah, okay.
He's gone. These shall become your property. You may keep them as a possession for your children after you, for them to inherit as property for all time. Such you may treat as slaves. But as for your Israelite kinsmen, no one shall rule you to sleep with you.
Okay. So here, and if you look in the verse I bolded in the Hebrew, V'gam mibnei hatoshavim hagarim imahem, Imachem mehem tiknu. Umi mishpachtam asher imachem asher olidu baritzachem vayu lachem la'achuzah. What is the major difference here? Yeah, you can buy foreigners. That's maybe not so surprising. The Nochrim, right? The Torah, let's remind ourselves here. The Torah takes for granted that there is an institution of slavery. Like, of course, people buy each other. That's not surprising. The surprising thing in the Torah would be to say, there's a class of people you are not allowed to buy. Right? That's the revolutionary thing. That revolution is only extended to Israelites, not to foreigners, but not even to Toshavim Agarim Imachem, the resident aliens. And here I think we see a very clear perspective that that status is passed down through the generations. That Ger Amaleki that David comes across, he can be bought and sold as a slave. All right? This is one of the key differences, sort of economically, basically interest, most likely, and certainly slavery, where the otherness of the Ger Toshav really remains other. All right? So this is, as I said, this is the part that's less rosy than some of what we'll see. We're not completely wiping out the distinction here, hardly, between Yisrael and Ger Toshav, and yet we did have this other statement about the Ger of love him like you would love yourself, make them like a native-born citizen. And so then the question is, well, are those conflicting impulses? Or no, you could love someone and treat them like a citizen in all kinds of ways, and in other ways not, right? Selling them as a slave seems like a big one to us, but I want to remind you again, the default thing is you can buy someone as a slave. The surprising thing is to definitively take someone off the slave market. Yeah?
So then why would it say at the beginning, when you're talking about an Israelite, it's not fair to go shabby yet? Like, you're allowed to buy the Toshav like a normal slave, but also when you buy an Israelite like a slave, they're a Toshav.
Good. So the terms here are being used in a somewhat slippery fashion. When it says kisachir ketoshav yeimach, the meaning of that phrase seems to be, when you buy someone as a slave in quotes, what you're actually doing, you should treat them like, and here, you know, the rabbinic parsing of this seems to get at the key meaning. A sachir is a short-term worker, and a toshav is a long-term worker. Right? A sachir is basically someone who literally comes into your house and works kind of by day on some regular job. A toshav has a long-term, basically, live-in job, right? So in other words, like a babysitter is a sachir, like an au pair is a toshav, okay? And the idea is even if, right, a certain kind of arrangement, like someone serving as an au pair or a nanny, a live-in nanny for like 4 years, could actually start to look like a certain kind of servitude, it's not. It's still kind of toshav. And that's the maximum point you can get there. Mibenei toshavim hagarim imachem is a way of saying, well, those people are residents, but they're not resident in the house of the employer. They're resident in the land, and you can buy them. Now, something I just want to be clear. In the dystopia laid out in other parts of Vayikra Perek Kaf Hei in this chapter, just so you see like what goes around comes around here, they talk about the possibility that a ger might end up buying an Israelite. Okay? So the thing, as we know from the curses in Deuteronomy that we started with, the ger is vulnerable to being taken advantage of, but that doesn't mean the ger can't become fabulously rich. Right? I think another interesting, like an important parallel here is to think about the position of Jews in various societies in which they were minorities. They could simultaneously be extremely vulnerable, sometimes get completely massacred, and then the window is right, they could fabulously be successful. Okay? That's true of the ger too. And in that sense, you also see in sharper relief, the deal is Israelite on Israelite, we don't buy each other as slaves. But they might buy us as slaves, and we might buy them, which again is the normal rules of the world. All right? But the Safir Toshav is sort of being used in two slightly different ways here, even though linguistically it's kind of the same word. Does that clarify? Great, okay. That's the part here where we don't have the same kind of fraternity, if you will, between Israelite and Israelite as we do between Israelite and Ger as Israelite and Israelite. Okay, now, with that, I want to proceed to the pieces that are surprisingly equal and to try to understand what they're about. So let's jump forward to page 4. If anyone maims his fellow as he has done, so shall it be done for him, to him. Shever tachat shever, ayin tachat ayin, shen tachat shen. Eye for an eye, the injury he inflicted on another shall be inflicted on him. One who kills a beast shall make restitution for it, but one who kills a human being shall be put to death. You shall have one standard for ger and ezrach alike. Okay? What's the, as we say, the hava amina? What's the idea that you might have thought that the Torah is shooting down?
This would be inequality.
Yeah, the inequality would be what? The ger might be worth less. I don't know, it's 3/5 of a person. Okay? I mean, you pick your valuation, all right? He's not worth as much, says the Torah. No, it doesn't matter. He is exactly like the Ezrach in terms of what we're talking about here, tort law. Okay? Now, on some level, that's like maybe, that's interesting, but probably the least surprising. Like, on some level, if you're going to acknowledge kind of the humanity and place of someone, then the most basic thing you can say is that their body parts are worth the same as you. Okay? The more surprising thing is when we get into other areas where I think we might have assumed the ger would be out, such as purity laws. Okay? You might have thought that purity laws would only apply to Israelites who are in some like spiritual system where these things matter. No, the purity laws are treated exactly the same. Kol nefesh asher tocham neveila utarifa ba'ezrach uvager v'chibes begadav rachatz b'mayim v'tameyada erev v'taher. Any person, it doesn't matter if they're a citizen or a stranger, native-born or resident, alien. If they eat something that's died and wasn't slaughtered, was torn by bees, it's a nevela, a trefa, they become tameh. They become unclean. If you look in the next section in Bamidbar in Numbers chapter 19, it's very clear all the procedures of corpse impurity apply to the ger. The ger comes in contact with a dead body, he'll have to go through the red heifer ritual of having ashes and water sprinkled upon him. And most surprising, if you turn to the top of page 5, is, so it's on the bottom of 4 in Hebrew and then on the top of 5, if you don't purify yourself, okay, after it says this applies to the Ezrach and to the Ger, if you don't purify yourself appropriately, v'nichrita ha-nefesh ahi mi-Yisrael, that person is cut off from the people. Right, what's known later in rabbinic literature is the penalty of karet. Very not 100% clear what happens. Well, how are you being cut off? Is it spiritual? Is it physical? You're dying young. You're dying childless. There's all kinds of ways of thinking about it. But it seems almost from the plain reading of that passage that the ger is not, doesn't just become impure, but if the ger is not careful about purity laws, he too could be cut off from some kind of collective. Okay? Now, this too could be sort of marginalized as only being about maybe purity laws, because maybe there's something like real about impurity that doesn't really have to do with the recipient of the impurity. Like the problem with corpse impurity might be that corpses actually defile in some real sense. Doesn't matter if I'm Jewish, I'm not Jewish. And therefore, the Torah is just addressing it to the people who live there. Okay, that's possible. We nonetheless still here have a kind of equation between Ezrach and Ger, that is taking us beyond just fairness. Yeah.
We have a sense of whether like this was followed or if like I feel like that's not like necessarily followed. Like that's putting more obligations on people that maybe we don't have the right to put obligations on.
Okay, good. So this goes back to like the categories I threw out at the beginning, right? Which is like, are there rights? Are there responsibilities? This definitely, right? I think it's important to emphasize. To say that the ger is like the ezrach, you can read that as saying, don't take advantage of him, give him all the privileges of the ezrach, but none of the responsibilities. You can also read it as, no, the ger has privileges, but also has to follow the same rules. Now again, from purity we can't extrapolate to that. We're going to get to sort of mitzvot in a minute, we're going to see some surprising things. But yes, you are pointing out correctly that there's different kinds of equality, and some of them demand more. The question, I think, as you put it, which is probably the right way to ask it, is, do we have the right to impose this on someone? That's already getting to the question of, well, what is the root? To the extent the ger is obligated in something, what is the basis of that? Right? Does it sort of just happen? Why is God obligating the hero? I'll try to understand. Right? Yeah, there we go.
Tumat Taharah framework reads much more like a public health campaign. Just as you would demand that citizens who are entering public schools get their MMR vaccines before they enter, so too undocumented people should get their vaccines, or visitors in the Curry coming has to get that. I don't think this is actually about spiritual value at all. It's about keeping everyone healthy.
Good. So I think that's definitely the way you could marginalize this text as not teaching you anything more than the local bit here. If you want to even go kind of play it out further, certainly the way, let's say, Jacob Milgram and others read this passage is, Kiyad Mikdash Hashem Timei, what happens is when corpse impurity is allowed to sit around and persist in human beings, the sanctuary is defiled and corrupted at a distance. And that happens as long as that impurity is around. So as long as the geir can become impure, then of course they have to take care of it. And your public health example is, I think, a good parallel of how we think about things of that sort. So yeah, that could be totally cabined off. Now I want to move us to mitzvot, because that I think is going to be harder to do. Something here is now going to change, at least in some of the examples we'll see. So when we start looking at religious obligation, we're going to see some things that are parallel to this way of saying, well, what do we have the right of to expect various religious behaviors from the ger? But it's very quickly going to take a surprising turn. Yeah, we have two comments over here.
I'm a little confused by the following. You seem to conflate all these inhabitants into one group. And I don't know that we've been careful about criticizing.
Yeah, okay.
About delineating, like, who's on first? And because we don't know who's on first, who's tribal, who's ethnic, and because of that, how do all these questions come up that should or should not apply?
What kind of differentiations might you draw?
Well, if it's tribal, and there's a certain, whatever word we want to use to describe that, you might say that's an in-group, and you follow from that tribal right. And the other people are the outsiders, and therefore you can make some separations, maybe on some things you do and some things you don't. But we really haven't, because we've jumped around in different parts of the Chumash, we haven't traced that ancestry, I'm calling again, as to who's on first. Because we don't know that, we're prima facie saying there should be differences. Why are you so surprised that there should be differences? If they're all this, if we're all from the same origins, we should be treated the same. Maybe the differentiation becomes later.
But in what sense are we from the same origins? You mean from like Adam and Eve?
Yeah.
We're
okay. All from so Adam and Eve, we're from Adam and Eve. Noah. So who's, that's what I'm saying. Who's here first? Who's on first? Until maybe there's some tribal. Is it from Abraham? Is it from?
Okay. Good. So first of all, I'm not invested in us being surprised. Like if you're like, yes, this makes perfect sense to me. That's fine. I think there's probably a reasonable percentage of us in the room who, when we read this, we're like, that's a little surprising, not least because the rabbinic legacy around this, which we're going to get to, in fact, carves up the ger into all kinds of subcategories. But right now, I'm actually just trying to read what is a pretty singular and consistent term, which is the ger, who is mentioned over and over. We're about to get to something that may feel like an inconsistency, but it seems pretty clear. There's no indication whatsoever that the ger is anything more or less complicated than a non-Israelite, because it always has to be B'nai Yisrael, v'hager, right? That's a separate category, who, nonetheless, lives there and is not a foreigner. And I'm just trying to track that in terms of the things that are spoken about. My categories here are just intended to give us what are some of the realms where this comes up. But right now, before we have reason to doubt that something, you know, more complicated might be going on, I'm trying to flow with this. We're gonna hit a problem in just 1 second. Okay?
The best proof that I have to you is the reverse, is that we're meant to look at ourselves in the land of slavery. Something went on there in which we were the outsiders, so therefore we gotta keep that in mind when we are now inside the Israelites, right, and those are the people, what differentiates
good
humanity?
So that much, I think, is reasonably clear, meaning once you have a verse, but of course we started with that, right? Once you have a verse that says, hey, you got to be good to the ger because you were gerim in Egypt, you might say, well, then I would expect all kinds of equality to flow from that. But I think the question which Hannah is raising is like, what is the degree of, what kind of equality? Because truth be told, from the slavery narrative, I might only deduce equality of not mistreating. But now we're starting to get into the realm of, would we say equality of, therefore you get an aliyah? Therefore you count in the minyan? I'm deliberately using later rabbinic terms, right? But in other words, so we start to feel, even in contexts where we might find any number of people that you and I might say, yes, I consider myself like the total equal and peer of that person, everywhere, the same citizenship, this, not the other thing. And you might nonetheless say, well, there are certain things where, though, like, it matters if you're a Jew or not. Or, things will look differently, this, that. Not necessarily because unequal, there's hierarchy, but it matters if you've gone through this step. That's the piece that I'm trying to sort of investigate now. Where does that take us? We might have thought a Tuma and Tahara might have been one line like that, impurity, even though there's a compelling case to say, no, that I would totally understand. Probably fewer of us would have thought there was a plausible case for tort law being unequal, but you might. You might say, I don't know, maybe the ger is not going to treat you fully equally if he had the upper hand. No, nonetheless, we toe that line. All right? When we get, I think the mitzvot piece is going to really flesh this out. Yeah.
Reacting a little bit to Eliana's comment about Tuma and Tahara being public health or spiritual, I'm wondering how you understand the lo yitkata et Mishkan Hashem, and what is the ger's relationship to the Mishkan based on this?
Well, he clearly affects it. Okay? It is very clear that the ger's failure to keep the laws of purity as he is supposed to has a bad effect on the Mishkan. Now, does that mean, we're going to get to this in a second, does that mean the ger goes and like gives sacrifices? Is the ger like a full citizen of the Mishkan? That would be a next question, but the ger is relevant, right? Clearly plugs in. Yeah, last comment on that.
When you were talking about Shahim Israel, also, like, what is that related? But does that mean that it seems to suggest that they're part of Israel before that?
Good, so we're going to get to places that are even sharper on that. But yes, that. So again, that you can say, no. It throws in the ger almost as a gloss. He has to keep these laws too. But of course he can't be cut off. That's to the Israelite. But wait, because we're going to see things I think it's much harder to say that with. Okay? Now, here's two things that are maybe what we would expect. Page 5, obligation and mitzvot. Lo tochlu chol nevela. Don't eat anything that died a natural death. That did die a natural death. That wasn't slaughtered. Okay? Don't eat anything that has died a natural death. What do you do with it? Lager asher misharecha titnena va'achala. Give it to the ger. He'll eat it. Or sell it to the nochri. Sell it to the foreigner. Now this is actually a marvelous verse. There's a rabbinic debate over how to read this, but I'm going to read it according to how Rabbi Yehuda reads it, which I think really captures it very powerfully. The ger is different from the nochri. That's the first thing you see. They're two different categories. And in fact, you treat them differently, which is the ger, you don't sell the nevela, the carcass, to the ger. You're supposed to be nice to the ger. So you give it to him for free. Okay? This presumes he wants the roadkill. Okay? You give it to him. The nochri, you can make a profit off of, because that's a totally transactional relationship. The ger is not a transactional relationship, titnena, but both the ger and the nochri are outside of the covenantal restriction around eating nevelot, around eating a carcass. All right? That seems to be the picture here in this verse, which matches the idea, like, how can we not expect the ger not to eat nevela? There's no reason he should have to refrain from that. And if you just had this verse on its own, you might well conclude, yeah, that seems like the ger doesn't keep mitzvot. Right. The ger gets protections and this and that, but it's a perfect example. He can actually violate things that are otherwise a big deal for an Israelite to violate. Yeah.
I'm just a little bit confused because Vayikra Yerzayin says they can't.
Oh,
Hold up. Right. So, but meaning that, you mean the text we already saw?
Yeah.
Correct. All right. Now we got to be a little careful. Okay? I'm going to get to the biblical criticism vort in a minute. Okay? But hold that at bay. Okay? For a second. I will just note to you the other thing, which is has its own problems. Vayikra actually does not say you can't be. Correct. So that actually is not a problem for the Ger, though if you make it not a problem for the Ger, it's a problem for the Israelite, because then it sounds like Vayikra has no ban on Yisraelim eating Nebelah, which Vayikra Kaf Bet kind of sounds like when it says Nebelah Utrefa Lo Yochlu Letomava about the Kohanim. All right? That's a whole other problem, okay, which we'll get to. We won't really get to, but we'll sort of refer back to. But for now, let's just note that we could say, well, the Ger might, even in that passage, not be allowed. But I agree with you. There does seem to be some tension between the way Dvarim splits around Nevelah as opposed to Vayikra unifying around Nevelah. Okay? That's text one that pushes the Ger out. Okay? Text two, which is implicit, is the next one about Sukkot. Basukkot teshvu shivat yamim kol ha'ezrach b'Yisrael yeshvu basukkot. Dwell in Sukkot for 7 days. And then very surprisingly, the only mitzvah in the Torah where it says, kol ha'ezrach, every native-born person should live in a sukkah. You are meant to clearly hear from that the ger does not need to live in a sukkah. Okay? Now, you could, based on these two, be like, yeah, here you see, the ger does not have to fulfill mitzvot. You could also imagine marginalizing these cases. You might say, Nevelah, it's not that big a deal. After all, it's a kosher animal. You know, okay, it died, but the same thing, had you slaughtered it while it was alive, would be okay. That far, we don't go with the ger. But the ger's not allowed to eat pig. Okay, right? That you could read it that way. And kol ha'ezrach b'Yisrael yeshvu basukkot, why might he be exempt from Sukkot? Because he doesn't have any land. Or where's he going to build the thing? Okay, or you can't expect that he will. Or, alternatively, maybe because the mitzvah of Sukkot is lema'an yedu dorotechem ki vasukkot oshavti epenei Yisrael, I want generations to know about the historical experience of the Exodus. The ger does not do mitzvot that are about the history of the Israelite nation. That might also be local, or have a few things that are like it, but most things not be. All right, so this is, I'm trying to also kind of get you to feel now, because it's going to be important for future weeks, the ways in which we have, in some ways this addresses some of your point, Nachum, which is to say, we do have a legacy here of text, but I want you to sort of start imagining how someone on the side of the spectrum of wanting the ger to be exactly like the Yisrael, the Ezrach, will turn the volume up on all the texts that equate them and find ways to turn the volume way down and marginalize the texts that divide them. And people really wanting to separate the Yisrael and the ger will find ways to do the exact opposite. Now, those are the exceptions to what otherwise is actually a pretty stunning list of all kinds of mitzvot that the ger is supposed to keep. And I'll just list it for you. Not allowed to eat chametz on Pesach, bottom of page 5. Must observe Shabbat. Ever pay attention to that in Kiddush? V'gercha asher bisharecha. Okay? And that too, you want to marginalize it? What can you say? No, it's telling the Israelites to keep Shabbat in the sense of don't work the gerim who are your labor force and they are like the slaves and therefore, you know, let them be, give them space. It's not about them observing it on their own. Okay, what are you going to do with Vayikra chapter 16 where the ger has to fast on Yom Kippur and the ger is not allowed to do malacha on Yom Kippur. Okay, then you go on. The ger is not allowed to offer on the bottom of 6 and into 7. You're going to take the packet home, and you're going to learn all of these in depth. I'm giving you the skira, the overview. On page 6 and 7, the ger, a whole bunch of things in that passage. The ger is not allowed to offer a sacrifice to another god, that is to say, to have some kind of sacrifice that's not brought
to the shrine that honors Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, the God of Israel. The ger is not allowed to eat blood. And the ger, when he kills game, basically birds or wild animal, where you are not going to put the blood on some kind of altar space, has to do kisui hadam, has to cover that blood up with dirt. Okay? And here too, the language is kol ochlav yikaret. And back in, where's the other one, where it says that good language of care? Well, yeah, here too, in Vayikra Yudzayin, in that last passage, it'll say, B'nei Yisrael, Beit Yisrael, and the ger, if you don't do this, v'nichrata yishahu me'amav. And it sounds like the ger is sort of in the people, has to be observing this stuff. If the ger doesn't fulfill those obligations, they're out. All right? Other things, the arayot, the forbidden sexual relationships, the Torah is clear, those apply to the ger. A ger is not allowed to marry his aunt. All right? Everything in that list, for instance, is also forbidden. That's on page 7, going into 8. Okay? And then other things around idolatry and blasphemy, etc. Okay? Now, to the extent you're like, this is crazy, I never heard of this, just sort of like teaser for next week, that's because the rabbinic tradition neutralizes all of these things by claiming that the ger mentioned in these psukim, in these verses, is the convert. Okay? But there's no convert here yet, right? So I just want you to, like, I'm noting that, but I want you to forget about that right now, and I want you to think about, what is the image of this person who is not Yisrael? They are not part of the group. They are protected. They are guaranteed certain things. But part of it is they're supposed to observe all kinds of mitzvot. Okay? Now here, too, you can have, I think, a limited and an expansive sort of thing. Right? So there was like a controversy the last couple of years in Israel around guards at the national parks on Pesach checking people's bags for chametz. Okay? And say, you're not allowed to bring it into the park. Okay? Including Arabs coming in. The notion of part of what the Jewish state is zoning on Pesach is you're not going to see chametz. Okay? Now, I'm not telling you that this was done after a lengthy study of the origins of the term ger in this verse, but I'm pointing to an instinct. You can read it as maybe these mitzvot, okay, are actually about sort of zoning the public space, but it's not about the ger really being a part of the covenant. It's the places where this is picked out. It's because those things are really important. All right? Shabbat, right? The notion that you would, like, shut stores down on Shabbat and say nothing can be open here, even if you say, well, no, but, like, what if this person is not Jewish, wants to say, I don't care. Right? The ger has to keep that, too. All right? Even when you've moved beyond the language of the ger, or you've gone through a rabbinic revolution if it only refers to converts, the instinct behind this vision does not totally disappear and die. Okay? And certainly there's a possibility of reading this much more robustly, which is the ger, by dint of being a minority resident or an other resident in this space controlled by Jewish power and the Torah, actually blends in to the ritual space as well. Right? Now that creates a much more comprehensive erasure of difference. Like you might still, in that vision, you have someone who you can lend them on interest. Okay, like there's a couple things like that. You might not have the kind of the mutual pact of not buying one another as slaves. But if you talk about sort of your ritual life, it's the same. Now, what I want to ask you, just sort of take a moment here, like, go with that more expansive vision here for a minute, okay? Just imagine for a minute that you're dealing with a character who has got to fast on Yom Kippur, and is not allowed to eat chametz on Pesach, has to keep Shabbat, etc., etc., but they're not an Israelite. Like, what is that? How do you understand that? What would that mean? What's going on? What kind of notion of society, citizen, place is at work that would lead to that sort of frame. Yeah.
I mean, it seems like one way it is to understand it as a process of assimilation. That as someone who maybe not have a lineage to claim, but is living in a society, they pick up and absorb the norms of that society, especially to the extent that that society is open to them.
Good. So what would that be most in tension with what we've seen so far? The seemingly hereditary nature of the Ger, right, where he sort of never fully disappears. But either you'd find a way around that, or you'd say it's very minor. Like, yeah, they're still kind of different. Maybe like the way a Kohen is different from a Levi, right? Like, there's some little thing you can't do. But like a Kohen and a Levi don't feel like they're two different peoples. It's like there's a couple of rules that apply differently.
That assimilation, right? The identity status doesn't shift. Mm-hmm. They don't become Israelite, but they're doing all the things that
right.
everybody, it's like American Jews celebrating Christmas. Mm-hmm. That's what everybody's doing.
Mm-hmm.
Many Jews don't give up their Jewishness in doing that. They just do what their peers are doing and what their friends are doing.
Great, and so play it out one more step. To the extent that the Torah has a positive vision around that, because right, there's something normative here, and so if we use your terminology, it would be, the Torah actually has a vision of the assimilation of the Ger. So what is that? Just playing out. We'll get another model in a second. But take it one more step if you can.
I mean,
if it's not just descriptive, right, but prescriptive, what's?
I guess it's that there's enough openness that process would happen, and once it's happening, we have to recognize it and legislate for it.
It's historic. It's not ritual.
Okay, great. Give another.
I don't think they're ever recognized as a citizen.
Okay.
But,
he agrees on that. Yeah.
Because, like in America, where you have all of these people who have to pay taxes. It's the rule of law, as long as they're earning reportable mm-hmm. income, et cetera, et cetera. But they can't vote. They will never be able to vote. And if, God forbid, as happened under Solomon, somebody decides to look and say, well, you're not really one of us. I can enslave you, even though you've been here for the last four generations. That's what Solomon did.
Yeah, so I think the part of the sort of taking advantage of, there the Torah is very clear, right? I think the question is how far does it need to be a package deal, or is the vision here that for there to really be a kind of not taking advantage of the other, you also have to assimilate the other, and maybe in terms of expectation. I know that's another spin I could put on of being normative. But the only way I'm really going to treat that guy the same is if I see him fasting on Yom Kippur. I know it's some vision of, unless really this person is acting in line with the covenant, then I'm not going to get to that place of equality. That's another way maybe to play it out. Yeah, in the back.
This is a question. Is there anything in this volume that talked about marriage yet, who can marry?
We'll get to that in a later thing. I'll also tell you I'm mostly not going to deal with that, but I am going to be giving a three-part series on intermarriage in the spring. Teaser for that. And the Ger Toshav will be a figure there.
People are together as closely
yes.
as that's where I was thinking.
That's correct. Correct. So I think the other thing that complicates it when we're looking at the biblical frame is it's not clear... It's not clear how to think about the female counterparts of the mainly male protagonists at play here, and therefore how to think about when intermarriage is a problem and for whom. The Torah is pretty clear about that vis-a-vis the seven nations that are indigenous. That is also another question, like how does the Ger get here, right? Was the Ger a refugee from another place? Or is the Ger, which like the Rambam seems to understand this, and the story of the Ger, the Amalekite Ger seems to be this, that like maybe if you were a seven nation person, but you like made peace and put down your arms, you'd become a Ger Toshav, right? Like you'd become a Ger in some way. That's unclear, and I'm going to leave the marriage prohibitions or lack thereof to the side. That's a great question because it really goes to, are we trying to blend everyone into one polity? It seems pretty clear not. But, and we'll get to the second of the Korban Pesach, which I think is going to push it to the most difficult and challenging place. You start talking about fasting on Yom Kippur, not doing work on Shabbat, all of this stuff, you start to be blending some pretty big categories. Yeah, back.
Isn't some of it also just that if you're here, you have to do what we're doing? Like, as Jews in America, you're going to sing in the choir, and you're going to sing Christmas carols, and just...
Yeah, suck it up, deal. Like, that's the
menorah. Like, you're here, you follow the rules, and we don't want anyone to see you leading on your
right, so I think there can be an optics thing. That's the sort of zoning thing, where it's like, this is the environment we're trying to create here. Yeah. So, like, you're just gonna, ripped from the headlines, you're just gonna say Merry Christmas. We're not going to have happy holidays here all over the place. Like, that's what we say in America. We say Merry Christmas, just say it, right? That's, right? That's the story. And you can apply that to all sorts of contexts and say that's what's going on. You know, you could have a more normative vision of that where you could also say, well, what is different after all about the ger as opposed, because here's, I think, is the interesting question. The test case would be, but when the Nochri walks out into the public square on Yom Kippur, does he have to fast? I think the plain sense of the Torah is no. Right? That's a sense in which I think zoning vis-a-vis what is happening in that place is probably not a sort of comprehensive explanation. It's something about the ger is like a part of the society in some way.
So we have to accept the society's rules. That's why it's important.
Yeah, and even it might. So the society, I think, is one frame. Another frame, which might distinguish the ger from the nohri, is the ger is rooted in the land. And it could be the land has certain laws that the god of that land commands. And if you live there, you have to follow that. If you're visiting, you don't have to, right? But if you live there, you have to. This is, by the way, another way of also possibly explaining, we won't get to this, but the you know another thing that is equated, which is in this next section on atonement and sacrifices, I'll just say it sort of off the page, is the notion that the plain sense in the Torah is if the ger does a sin, the ger has to bring a sacrifice to atone for it. And if the ger accidentally kills someone, the ger goes to the cities of refuge that are set up not only for Israelites, but for the ger. Whereas it's very clear, like a nohri can't wander into one of those. It's not just a general sort of place of asylum. Okay, it is a place where someone who lives on the land and who has the capability to pollute the land as a resident of that land, right? Lo tachanifu et haaretz, it says there. That person has to be accountable. So I think then one of our interesting questions would be, can we translate this to sort of all social majorities? Or is this something about like the land of Israel and the Jewish people's presence there? Okay, great. Yeah.
What seems to me interestingly caught in tension is like there was no civil law back then, so it was all religious law, but at the same time there's this sort of sense almost like within the text that they're pushing towards, like if you kill someone that's clearly less religious, though it is also religious, where versus the, you know, giving a sacrifice, you know, it's like this spectrum of how much God is in this versus how much this is just sort of a kind of like about
Right, so I think, right, you're using civil law in the sense of secular law.
Secular law, right, which is different from in America. Like,
yeah, so the Torah, right, the Torah, I think, in very deep ways, just doesn't know really what you're talking about, right? Not you, right? If someone comes along and says, like, oh, you know, this is this kind of rule and this kind of rule, and here God's more involved and God's less involved, Chazal, rabbinic sources already talk about that a little more. That whole perspective seems to be totally absent of the Bible, right? It's like the God that commands you to bring this sacrifice is the God that commands you to be fair and not to take the millstone of someone and to fast on Yom Kippur, etc.
But within the ger, it's almost like it's sort of mapping that out in a really kind of vague way, right?
Well, I think it's crossing categories. That's part of what's interesting here. We started with tort law, but it seems like we're also talking about a whole bunch of other things.
But not all.
Which, where do you see it stopping, though?
I don't know.
So far, so what I'm sort of pointing out to you is, the, other than this anomaly of the nevela and the sukkah, okay, the carcass and building the sukkah and sukkot, the trend is towards, in almost every place, you see the ger. I mean, literally, if you do like a search and like a concordance lookup on the ger, almost every time it's mentioned in the legal parts of the Torah, it is mentioned with the ezrach. That is to say, the whole point of its mention is to say, don't think this person's any different. They're exactly the same, right? Other than basically those two places.
Are you sure about the Sukkot one?
That it must exclude the ger?
Yeah, because it doesn't really say that.
It says, Kol ezrach b'Yisrael yeshuv b'Sukkot. The question is why?
The question is, what's an ezrach? Because it doesn't say exclude the ger like the...
No, it's by implication. Look, as I said, if you're inclined to obligate the ger and everything, you can maybe find a way to put it in. We'll see next week what Chazal do to that verse. But the Nivela text, for sure, allows the ger to eat something that the Israelite cannot. Okay? I want to just hold, I'm going to give you a last comment here, okay? And then we'll make sure we get around at the end.
I'm just curious because, whatever, we're writing some guys, so obviously. So with your exception, that's not the way that it's talked about in Devarim, where it specifically lists that, like, the widow and the stranger, the ger, has to also dwell in a sukkah and celebrate Shavuot with you.
No. It says when you celebrate Sukkot, you have to rejoice with them. Now that's not clear that they have an obligation to be in a sukkah or in a booth. Okay? Never mind that the passage in Devarim doesn't talk about building a sukkah at all. It says Haga Sukkot, so presumably there's some sukkah there. Okay? But I'm just saying the emphasis there is not on that. It's parallel exactly to the Shavuot text, which is share your stuff with them. Okay? But you can. But I'm not trying to fight back on that. I mean, if you want to read it expansively,
it's fine. I viewed a mental note before that was like, oh, these people have to do it with us too.
Yeah. So I think the thrust there is much more about you have to share your bounty with them, right? It's be'os pecha migornecha umiyikvecha. When you gather in this stuff, you might be sitting in a booth, but you have gathered in all of this bounty from your harvest, and you're having a big party. You better invite those people. Right, that, I think, is the plain sense of those verses. And you do seem to have the simple implication of the Sukkot verse of the building it, is that they don't have to. They don't have to live in a sukkah. But okay, we can quibble of maybe there's ways of getting around that. I want you to just see a few. We have 10 minutes to round out to the end here, okay? Let me show you, I think, the most sort of surprising things here. On the bottom of 10, this is on some level the most fateful passage. God said to Moshe and Aharon, this is the law of the Pesach, of the Passover offering, the Korban Pesach, the sacrifice, called Ben Nechar Lo Yochal Bo. The Nuchri, the foreigner, cannot eat from it. But any slave a man has bought may eat of it once he has been circumcised. Okay, so that's a slave. That's now a person belongs to you. They're an extension of you. We do see there's a concern here about the orla, the foreskin, the lack of circumcision is somehow a problem for the Korban Pesach, not explicated why. No toshav or sachir can eat of it. So if you have someone who works for you, but you don't own them, they're just live-in help, or certainly if they're just like showing up regularly to work for you, that's not attached enough to you to bring them in. They're still a nochri. They remain a foreigner. Okay? Okay, eat it in one house, don't break a bone, everyone's got to do it, etc. 48. V'chi yagur itcha ger. Another great place where you see the ger is not the nochri. If there's a ger who lives with you, ve'asa pesach ladonai, and does a pesach offering to God, himol lo kol zachar, ve'az yikrav la'asoto, ve'ayake ezrach ha'aretz, ve'chol arel lo yochal bo. After circumcising all males, so it seems like, by the way, it means not only does he have to be circumcised, but like he's got to circumcise all his kids. If anyone in his family is uncircumcised, he might still be barred, okay? Then he can participate in the Korban Pesach and be like the Ezrach HaAretz, okay? But no uncircumcised person can eat from it. And then Torah achat yihyeh la'ezrach v'la'ger agar b'tochachem. One rule for the Ezrach and the Ger. Now, there's two ways to read this text, right? The way that is in keeping with what we've seen so far would be to say there's one rule for the Ezrach and the Ger. I meant what I said. I said what I meant. He's really your equal. There's this thing that you have to be circumcised. That's true of everyone. An Israelite who's not circumcised also can't eat the Pesach. And the Ger, because he's not an Israelite, is more likely to be uncircumcised. By the way, that also probably indicates that the Ger does not have to be circumcised.
because otherwise, what do you mean he's showing up suddenly and needing to do this? Seems to be another distinction. A ger does not need to be circumcised. If he wants to be a part of the Pesach, he'll have to be circumcised. But other than being circumcised in this reading, why can't he participate in the Korban Pesach? He remains a ger. He's not an Israelite, but he is part of it. Okay? Now, this is the equivalent of saying, basically, vis-a-vis ritual things. If the ger wants to participate, as long as there's not some local thing like circumcision and the Pesach that gets in the way, yeah, the ger can participate. The nochri can't, but the ger can. By dint of being resident in the land, basically, they can get in and be a full part of the life of the community in that way. That's reading one. Reading two, which I think you would only adopt if reading one made you nervous. And part of what we're going to talk about next time is what would make you nervous about reading one, or what made Chazal and rabbinic sources nervous, would be to say, no, there's some kind of conversion going on here. The circumcision is not just removing a physical part of the body that has a matter-antimatter relationship with the Korban Pesach. What is happening is actually, by removing the foreskin, then he can do the Pesach. Why? V'haya ke'ezrach ha'aretz. Because by circumcising, he will become like the Ezrach. Okay? Now, at the end of the day, I don't think that reading really works. Because the final line here of one rule for the Ezrach and the Ger indicates that they remain in two separate categories, but they have to be treated the same. Not that we're talking about the process whereby the Ger becomes an Ezrach, but nonetheless, this text becomes key in later discussion of the Ger and understanding what's going on, because depending on how you read it, you will either get to a radical equalizing inclusion, even in the peak ritual event of the Korban Pesach, which is basically like how you demonstrate your membership in the community of Israel. Okay, right? This is the Seder. Okay, this is like your once a year, like checking off, I am a part of the Jewish people. This is the story that I tell. And to say, the Ger is a part of that story, is one sort of intense frame, as opposed to, no. The move towards circumcision is doing something here because I can't swallow or comprehend or understand what that first model would be. But I want you to understand the possibility of that first model here and what it says about the ger, okay? I'm gonna end with, you're gonna give me your questions. I want to just refer you to here, I and J give us a window into how you might take that even more extreme places. We referred to inheritance earlier. Yechezkel, in envisioning the second commonwealth being reborn and how the tribes are going to come back and redivide up the land, says the tribes are going to divide up the land and the ger, the ger's descendants also get to have plots of land. This, by the way, seems to undo the basis of assumption of everything the ger meant throughout the Torah, okay? Which, if anything, seems to be like Yechezkel's vision. Something amazing or shocking is going to happen in the next reborn Jewish commonwealth. But how are you going to put the ger isn't part of a tribe? So how is it going to work? Whatever territory the ger lives in, he inherits with that tribe. He happens to live in Yisachar, so he divides up with Yisachar. All right, he happens to live in Yehudah, he gets with Yehudah. It's basically like, think of it as, every 10 years you do a census in the United States, and that's how many electoral votes you get for the next cycle. That's what it's like. The tribes do a census, basically, of the places where they live, and the gerim get thrown into the lot each time anew. Okay? Now, I don't know what to tell you about that passage in Yechezkel. That passage in Yechezkel has one of two effects on us. It either tells us, oh, this is like a radical undoing of what the Torah stood for. Or now I go back and I start to think, well, I don't know, maybe the ger meant kind. Maybe the ger is someone, or at least something who can become an Israelite, because it sure seems like they're becoming an Israelite here. Okay, I'm not sure how to read Yechezkel.
But forgetting about what the plain meaning of Yechezkel is, the effect of Yechezkel on us is sort of radicalizing in one way or the other. It's either going to lead you to begin to sort of dissolve the boundary between anyone who happens to live in the land of Israel. They sort of just like become one people. Okay, talk about a one-state solution. Or it makes you go back and say, this can't be. The only person I could possibly say this about is someone who like became an Israelite. And now I'm wondering where that was happening in all the earlier places in the Tanakh. This, I would say, the further sort of aggravation of that is in Dvarim and these other passages in J, where you seem to have a notion of, I'm not talking about section J on the sheet, okay? I'm not doing biblical criticism breakdown, okay. The notion that actually you read certain passages in the Torah collecting the whole people together in a covenantal mass, the ger is there. The most striking is the mitzvah of Hakel, the mitzvah once every 7 years to gather the entire people to hear the Torah. It's a command performance for the ger. He is supposed to show up there. Okay? Talking about leaving someone alone, right? So, okay, I don't want to, fine, you'll make me not eat nevela, but you're going to make me come to shul, right? It's unbelievable, right? There's this sort of notion of actually the collective includes that person. Again, it doesn't include the foreigner necessarily, but even that, we may return to this source next time. If you look at K, a text that we have all seen, I feel pretty confident, or you've seen at some point, many of us have heard it sung many times a year on the afternoon of fast days. You actually start talking about B'nei Hanechar Hanilvim Al Hashem. Foreigners who join on with God, these are now actually Nochrim, foreigners who are starting to keep Shabbat, who are doing all sorts of things that seem like they're ritually for Jews. And the final line of that Haftorah, I don't know how much people ever focus on this, Oda Kabetz Alav Lenik Batzav, the plain sense of that verse is, when there are foreigners who want to actually somehow join themselves to God's laws and practices and the practices of the Jewish people, they will be gathered in as exiles along with the ingathered exiles of the Jewish people. That's why I called that section Religion Unbound. There's a sort of element in Yeshayahu where you could imagine reading a vector through the entire Torah that gets to a place where what ends up happening is people completely independent of ethnic background get drawn in to the covenant of Israel. Sounds like Christianity, okay? And I want you to sort of understand that, because this is going to be when we enter next week into the rabbinic take on this, that will sort of be the moment where you can imagine slamming on the brakes. I got to take this in a different way or understand what's happening, but I don't want you to underestimate the power of the thrust throughout the sources we've seen of the ger kind of being treated part of this collective, being normalized in some kind of way, in a way that threatens to actually spill beyond the bounds of the Jewish people itself. Okay, I'll stop there just to allow a couple final comments here. Both of you to get up and go, you're welcome. Yeah.
Question about the source of J, that you didn't need some new source of that. This passage is situated narratively before the entrance into Eretz Israel.
Mm-hmm.
So to the extent that the categories of Ger and Ezrath are tied up with residence and having roots in a shared land, how does that work?
Like how do you talk about the Ezrath not having gone in yet?
Who are the Gerim that are with you in the Midbar?
Yeah, so this is a great question, right? So an easy answer is you can say the Erev Rav and other people who basically joined along and were there throughout, who were not a part of the people, right? In some way, right? I mean, that's certainly Rashi, right? Almost every time, like, Am appears and I hear it's like, oh, that's the Erev Rav. So they're like there, hanging out and doing stuff. That's one sort of literal answer. I think the other way, though, that you have to understand is all of these mitzvot have a certain element of, like, you know, nivuah, projection forward, application in the land, even if they apply in theory before the land, that I think is just using terminology that is going to be the terminology and is the terminology. Exactly. Right. They're not chopping a lot of wood in the desert. Though by then they're in Arvot Moab, there's some trees there. But yeah, that's how I think you have to understand. Yeah, Al.
I just wanted to touch back on the circumcision that we were talking about.
Yeah.
How if you were circumcised, you were allowed to do certain things. One of the things that I thought was really interesting is that, for the most part, every culture in the Near East practiced circumcision, except for the nations from, like, the Greek, from Greece, essentially, and the Philistines being settlers from Greece. They're the only people that really didn't practice circumcision. So I think, for the most part, it was just an invitation saying, regardless of whether or not they're a ger or not, they're still invited.
Right. I mean, of course, the story of Shem and Hamor and Dinah presumes that the residents there are not circumcised, and they're the Chivim, and they're indigenous. So I'm not sure. In other words, it depends on who the ger is, right? Is the ger some Philistine who came in and is living among you as opposed to on the edges threatening you? Is the ger a remnant? And here's the other thing I want to be very careful about this. Is the ger a construct? Okay, right, I think this is the part I want to be very cautious about. I don't know how much we can concretely say how many gerim of this sort or that sort there are at X date. According to Divrei Hayamim, there were 153,600 of them, right, in the time of Shlomo. So, okay, but like who, where, what, that might be important. It might also be that on some level, the Torah doesn't care about that. By which I mean the Torah is laying out a vision for here's how society is supposed to work. The question of how many people in the past or in this place, you know, fit that category, that may be another matter. Okay. We're going to give you the last word, Eliana.
We started with two examples of places where Parvian starts. We started with two examples of places that are different between Gary and everybody else.
Yeah.
We've gone to an entire list of where they're not. So if we were to read it backwards and have started with the ones where they are obligated and then go to the ones where they're not obligated, what rationale do you have for, like, Nevela and maybe Sukkot where they're not obligated?
Right, so Sukkot, I suggested to you that it may just be about they don't have land, or Sukkah is a deliberate, it's this very specific mitzvah of sort of remembering and reenacting Israelite history, and the ger doesn't have to do that. The ger is grafted onto the story later and doesn't have to do that stuff. By the way, if you say that, and you read the Pesach offering in the more expansive way I did, it tells you something interesting, which is then the Korban Pesach is not actually about the Exodus. Like, it might have roots in that, but like that's not what it's about. It's about some sort of national reorientation from here and going forward. So that itself would be sort of an interesting implication. And then I also mentioned in terms of the Nevelah, you'd have to marginalize it. I'm not saying it's great. You'd have to marginalize it by saying it is, it's a sort of minor offense. Like, you couldn't eat pig. But Nevelah is much less serious. Now, on some level, again, just as so to fulfill my promise before of at least referring to the biblical critical analysis on this, sure, a cut and dried, like, willing to just, you know, splice and dice the Torah into however many parts approach would say, Dvarim and Vayikra don't have the same view on that. Dvarim thinks that, like, the ger is allowed to eat Nevelah, and Vayikra thinks that the ger is not allowed, right? In other words, and you sort of play it out that way where there's two different things there. You can obviously drill down on that, either from a biblical critical perspective or for a sort of multivocality element of the Torah perspective and say, what you might be feeling there is the Torah itself has a slightly uneven perspective on this character, which only reinforces for us that this person is sitting in a sort of liminal space, being brought in a deep way, by not being totally brought in. And that's clear, I think, even reading the Torah totally synthetically, even putting Nevelah and Sukkah aside with the interest and slavery pieces, they still remain other. And therefore, the question may be how much of the difference, in the, you know, where the differences appear, how much of those are about them being other, how much of them are about the local mitzvah, and it tells us something about how that's understood, and how much do we maybe, in sources like Yechezkel and Yeshayahu, see some sort of like taking the message of the Torah sort of in one direction or another, or we can imagine it being interpreted in a number of different ways. We're going to stop there and leave your appetite whetted for the rabbinic sources, which we will turn to next week. Thank you.